Some potential abuses of sensitive data. I don't think I need to go into that too much, but just pointing out that, you know, I'm not just talking about sort of personal data, but maybe corporate data or even government sensitive data. So, you know, this isn't just sort of something that individuals care about. Privacy should be something that corporations and governments care about as well. So surveillance and data mining is a very popular or useful or common way of dealing with lots of data, which is to take together lots of data from diverse sources, and for the purposes of, for example, law enforcement and homeland security, you want to analyze this data to try and detect and ideally thwart possible incidents before they occur. If you can't do that, at least you'd like to be able to recognize that an incident is underway. So if there's some kind of epidemic of a disease going on, it's actually useful to try and tell, notice early that it's going on, as well as maybe being able to tell, is this a natural disease or you know, a purposely caused epidemic, because it may be different how you want to deal with it. Or if you can't, even you know, before or during, at least afterwards, you may be able to use this kind of data to identify and prosecute criminals or terrorists after incidents occur. And of course, these aren't the only applications. Biomedical research is one where, you know, taking lots of data lets you perhaps discover what kinds of drugs are good for what kinds of diseases. And of course, it's actually been going on much longer than all of that for marketing and personalized customer service, which, you know, in all of these cases, it's very easy to construct arguments why this is a good thing, as well as constructing arguments why there are privacy issues and worries about misuse of sensitive information. So the broad goal of privacy-preserving data mining is to allow multiple data holders to collaborate to compute some kind of important information. So we say we want to compute this, we want to protect the privacy of other information, and again, it can be in any of these arenas. Technical tools to do this include cryptography, which the solutions I'm going to talk about largely lie in there, but others have been used as well, data perturbation and sanitization. You can try and do some of it with access control, things like inference control to understand what inferences can be drawn from information, as well as trusted platforms to help make some of the assumptions of trust boundaries perhaps more instantiated. And so some of the advantages of privacy protections, as I was talking about, this is not just, you know, so protection of personal information, that's what the privacy nuts care about. You know, when you talk about sort of the individuals who are very vocal about privacy, usually that's what people are thinking of. But again, this is also useful for companies that might want to collaborate with each other or with government organizations, because it can enable collaboration between different data owners that may be more willing or legally able to collaborate if they don't have to reveal their information to do so. And it can even help with compliance with legislative policy. So HIPAA is a US policy about medical data. European Union also has some privacy directives, and this is not yet tested in the courts, but if you can say, you know, I want to do this great medical study, and because I'm not sharing any information with anyone, I perhaps don't have to go through and obtain consent from every single person whose data is involved. So, and one of the goals, and maybe I should have reordered the slides a little bit for this audience. So one of the goals of most of the work in privacy-preserving data mining is to recognize you're dealing with huge amounts of data, and you're dealing, you know, with people who actually want to run your algorithms. And so you want to be practical to the extent possible. And so usually the models that are looked at for the data being divided are intended to model some kind of real-world setting. So people look at horizontally partitioned data. So here I'm looking at sort of a virtual table-structured database. Here you have, you know, two or more parties holding some of the records or rows of this table, and the attributes, so this might be, you know, various financial data, medical data, demographic data, things like this, and we assume in the horizontal partition, you assume that they have full records for each of the different people or entities in the database, but they're divided among the different data owners. Vertically partitioned is the reverse, where you have, again, this virtual database, and two or more parties own some of the data. One will have, say, all the financial data, one all the medical data, about the same set of people. If you want to go a little more general, then you can have arbitrarily partitioned data, not probably terribly realistic here, so again, two or more parties have some division of the data. The nice thing about solutions in this model is they can be applied to both models, and it also kind of covers high hybrid cases where maybe you have, you know, one party with a few extra records with all the data, and maybe some other kinds of, you know, mostly vertically partitioned, but a little bit spread. And another model I like that I'm not going to talk about too much today, I guess I'll mention some of our work in this area, is the fully distributed model. So this is the model where you own your data, each person has control of their own data, and they get together and decide what computations they want to engage in or not engage in. And then you can also think about the client-server model as fitting into the distributed data mining setting, where you have some client that wants to do some computation on a bunch of data held by servers. The servers shouldn't learn each other's data or have to divulge their data to the client, and the client shouldn't have to tell the servers what computation it wants to do. So, as probably many of you already know, the first solutions to privacy-preserving data mining were introduced in 2000 in two papers by the same title, Privacy-Preserving Data Mining, taking different approaches. One was Lindell and Pincus, which was using a cryptographic solution to compute ID3 decision trees, which is a kind of, so I should say, perhaps if you're not familiar with data mining, the goal of many data mining algorithms is because you have this huge data, you want to summarize it in some way for some task. So perhaps you want to compute, some kind of small representation that's going to allow you to predict certain values of certain new records as they come in, or to classify records as they come in. So ID3 decision trees are a kind of decision tree that help you do these kinds of tasks, and they showed how you can provably compute the ID3 decision tree between data held by two parties horizontally partitioned in your case, provably leaking nothing else. And in the database community at the same time, Agarwal and Srikant had a solution actually also for ID3 decision trees, and what they did was random perturbation of the data. They showed how from these perturbed data, which you would then, the different parties would just send to each other, you could compute reasonably accurate ID3 decision trees for the data held by two parties while obscuring the original data, meaning that what you sent wasn't really the actual original data, but there's not so much of a provable guarantee here. And this is actually a slide I copied from Benny. I hope you don't mind. just kind of comparing the two approaches. So you can look at various ways that they kind of trade off different things you would like. So where you want to be is down in here. You want lots of privacy, so there's less privacy out here, more privacy in here. You want good accuracy. Your solutions should look more or less like what they would have if you had actually brought the data into one place and done your computation. So you want more accuracy, not less. And you'd like to be more efficient, not less efficient. So the cryptographic approach is very good. You can, in theory, get complete privacy and complete accuracy. I should say, both privacy and accuracy are with respect to some reference function that you want to compute. So you could talk about, is this decision tree itself leaking, or is the decision tree itself an accurate object? But for now, let's ignore both of those. So you can compute exactly what you would have computed in the trusted third-party model, but at some loss of efficiency. The randomization approach is much more efficient, so that's down closer to here, but appears at least to suffer a trade-off between privacy and accuracy. You can see the two endpoints pretty clearly. If you erase the data and replace it with random data, very good privacy, very bad accuracy. If you do nothing to the data, very bad privacy, but complete accuracy with respect to what you would have done. And there's some evidence that, so you might hope that the randomization approach kind of went like this, and that you could find a nice, good spot in here. There's some evidence that at least for some problems, it goes the other way. Although there are some problems where there seems to be, you can do a little better. So the goal of both of these bodies of work is to try to improve on those dimensions. And there's actually sort of so I think this is a great open area for further research. I mean, if you could quantify, so there are some definitions that do try to quantify privacy, so that you can talk about not just the cryptographic, complete semantic security type privacy or not, but you can say sort of how much privacy does one solution have relative to another. Accuracy also, if you're dealing with a particular computation, there's some hope you can quantify it. Efficiency you can quantify as well. But another thing, and so there's more work needed on what are meaningful quantifications of all of these things, and then can you actually prove trade-off results that says, what space here there are solutions and what there aren't. And there's actually a third aspect as well of solutions, which is generality. So if you have, with secure multi-party computation, you can use your very general solutions that apply to every function, but they're less efficient than if you take a tail solution for each problem, but you need then researchers to come up with these tailored solutions, and you need to implement them new. So you know, the generality is sort of nice, but seems to come at a cost. And also very important, and I didn't know where to put it because it's not really orthogonal, is the notion of utility. So it's related to accuracy. The more accurate the data is, the more useful generally, but also to generality, because if you have some algorithm or some publishable data that can be used for many things, that's more useful to someone who wants to extract those things from it. Although, you know, potentially, you know, my privacy may be your utility. So it's very hard to imagine what a general result would look like there.
So you said there are some attempts to define privacy laws. Are there any attempts in the database community to define privacy? Have they ever?
I mean, there's sort of in the recent years, I think some of the people that have been involved in that work has been there, like Johannes Gerke did some work. It turns out, I think, so maybe someone's going to talk, maybe Kobe or Adam or someone is going to talk on later in the week more about some of that stuff. Yeah, right. I mean, we are going to hear here. From the data side. I mean, okay, and I should say, you see in some of the database papers what looks, you know, like there's some wording about more private, less private, but, you know, it's not really quantifiable. And it's not clear how to quantify, right? Because bits are not just bits, right? More bits and less bits. There's important bits and less important bits. So it's not even clear what that should look like. You know, in this audience, you're probably all familiar with secure multi-party computation, which is, you know, a beautiful, very general tool that allows n players holding n inputs to privately compute a function f of their inputs, and it can either be that they all get the same output or all different outputs. Doesn't really matter too much. And the overhead of doing so is polynomial in the size of the inputs and the complexity of the function. And under some, you know, circuit depth or some other representation of the function. So the problem for us here, so the data mining functions may or may not be particularly complex, but the size of the inputs is generally assumed to be quite large. And so in theory, we could use this to solve any of these private distributed data mining problems, but in practice it's not going to be efficient enough for large data. And so there's been, you know, sort of since the 2000 paper, a bunch of papers looking at specific data mining problems of interest, either data mining products or sort of common tools that are useful in lots of data mining computations, and coming up with privacy preserving, meaning secure function evaluation versions of them. Some of them take the cryptographic approach, as mine does. Some of my work leaks specific, not quantifiable, but nameable pieces of information. Some of the work takes the randomized approach and is a little vaguer about what's leaked. Ideally, you want something that leaks nothing, that sort of satisfies the full definition of secure multi-party computation of that function. So there are some open questions here as well. What I'm going to talk about today is joint work with my student Yang, Jiqing Yang, on privacy-preserving construction of Bayesian networks on vertically partitioned data. In some other work, also joint with Sheng Zhang, we looked at something that I like to think of as something you can think about as this privacy utility trade-off. So what we noticed is that if you have frequencies, meaning if someone can tell you how many tuples in the data or your records in the data are consistent with various tuples of combinations of data. So how many people have blue eyes and blonde hair, how many people have brown hair and brown eyes, et cetera, then you can use that to compute various kinds of data mining results. So you can use it for naive Bayes classification, for decision trees, for association relining. Now, it's sort of a policy decision in any given setting or a privacy decision. Are you willing to allow those frequencies to be revealed? Because they reveal more than any one of these alone, or at least certainly not less, since they let you compute those things. But it at least, you know, if you're having trouble trying to convince someone they want to use something like this because they say it's too inefficient, you can say, well, at least maybe you can, and this isn't a fully distributed model, so you can say, you know, at least this one will let us keep all our data. We're going to reveal these frequencies, but not the individual values of everyone's data. And then we also have some work with my student Geeta and long Indian name beginning with a P that I'm not going to even try to mispronounce. privacy-preserving clustering. We looked at k-means clustering for arbitrarily partitioned data. This is an example where our solution leaked some intermediate information. Paul Bunn and Rafi Ostrovsky have since gotten an improved solution that's both works in the malicious model, where ours did not and does not have that intermediate leakage. So that's a nice improvement there. And then we had, because we wanted to avoid this intermediate leakage, we took a different approach, which is we said, well, let's see if we can come up with a different clustering algorithm specifically designed to, you know, use operations that we think we know how to do privately, but that also will produce good clusters. That's actually why we added this co-author, because he's a data mining person, and so he was able to help us figure out what might be a good data mining algorithm that was, you know, constructed from the start to be both good at the data mining and good at lending itself to private computation. So I'm not going to talk any more about these today, but I'll go into some detail here, including telling you what Bayesian networks are. So, as I said, usually the goals of the data miner are to come up with some concise representation taken from some data that then is used, you know, from some training data perhaps, or maybe the actual data that they want to find patterns in, that will help them to do various kinds of pattern-based searches or classification or prediction of values. And a Bayesian network is a graphical model that encodes probabilistic relations among variables, meaning the attributes, the columns of the data, and is very useful for representing knowledge about uncertain variables and can be also used as a computational architecture for computing probabilities that you don't know based on probabilities or evidences of probabilities that you do know.
Sorry, I have a very basic question.
Yes?
You said that if you had secure computation, then you could solve the problem efficiency. But I don't understand,
Yeah, so I mean, so think about, you know, so you have some data analyst who's a person,
okay,
who's going to be sitting somewhere,
okay,
and for that data analyst, you want to represent data, I mean, let's think about the homeland security setting, right? You maybe want to represent data about people flying on airplanes, and, you know, perhaps you have sensors doing various things, and it's very loose data and raw data, and one person can't look at it, and so... you know, data mining is the term that is intended to kind of encompass all the, in many ways, heuristic methods that we have of representing things about data that make it more useful for a person to
try.
Right.
So, how does the pure multiparty computation come into play there?
So if the data sources that these data are coming from are different parties, so maybe, you know, we've decided that Bayes networks are very useful. And so you want a Bayesian network, but it's going to come from, you know, data held by France and Israel and the U.S. Who don't want to put their data together. Or it's going to come from individual information from all the people in this room, and we don't want to put it together. So the parties or data holders, which may themselves be aggregating some data, but you don't want to take the next step of aggregation.
I see. So private-preserving data mining is not... If you can do secure computation efficiently, it's not done in storage. That's for some settings. But then there's settings where there's also...
I mean, yeah, okay, there's sort of a class of problems for which it would solve it. There's others, sometimes people want publishable data, right? And they want to be able to do data mining on publishable data, but publishing data that is some way transformed to protect the privacy of those who are under. So you're right, it was a bit of an exaggeration when I said secure multiparty would solve everything, but it solves this class of problems, but even then there are efficiency issues. There's also still privacy issues about the thing that is revealed. Right, I mean, you know, so if you're the non-terrorist who gets accidentally matched on a watch list because your name is there, you probably consider that a privacy issue, even though it was a real match of a name against a name. So there's certainly privacy issues about the results, and there are settings where the data is either already aggregated or you want to do something beyond a fixed computation. Yeah, that's a good point. So, more specifically, a Bayesian network consists of two parts, BS and BP. The BS is a directed acyclic graph that each node in the graph is representing a variable, an attribute, a or a column in the table in the database, and the edges are representing probabilistic relationships among the variables. Specifically, direct conditional relationships are represented by edges, and then there's associated with, so this would be saying that, given x1, you can compute probabilities on x2, and then each edge is associated, each node is associated with a table that says, given possible values of all the parents, so if there were many parents here, this would be a longer table here with all the possible tuples of values for the parents, given all the possible values for the child node, what are the conditional probabilities of the value of x2 given the value of x1. And so in a somewhat larger case, you might have this example with various symptoms and actions or medical conditions, and each of these nodes will have a table associated with it. And so if I go back here, right, this is saying the fact that there's no edge here says that everything you need to know about tuberculosis and cancer, you can determine from tuberculosis and cancer, and it doesn't matter at that point whether there was a visit to Asia or not, even though the visit to Asia has an impact on the likelihood of tuberculosis. And in fact, in general, when you compute with these things, you want to maybe limit some of the edges, so sometimes you want the stronger relationships and you'll omit the weaker relationships for the purposes of the things the data miners use. So they've turned out to have a wide variety of applications in industry, in the military, in medical diagnosis, in commercial settings. So they're very useful. Lots of people do things, and I don't know everything about what they do, but they do things with these Bayesian networks that they construct from data and then use to decide on business processes or figure out, you know, what the problem was when something goes wrong, you know, in a person or in a space shuttle. So our goal is going to be, say, okay, we want to compute these Bayesian networks, and we're going to do it in a two-party setting, so there's just two data providers. Perhaps Alice has a bunch of financial data about, you know, some body of people, U.S. citizens, and Bob has all the medical data, or whatever it is. It's hard to give any real examples without being somehow yucky. But let's just say they have two different kinds of data. And what I'm going to show here is how they compute this network structure. We also have a solution to compute the parameters, the probability tables that go with each node, but I'm not going to talk about that today. So the goal is they're going to do some kind of computation. They're both supposed to learn this relationship between, you know, the probability relationships among these nodes that consist of her data and his data, but they're not supposed to learn. Alice is not supposed to learn anything else about Bob's data. Bob's not supposed to learn anything about Alice's. Now we'll see that actually our solution is going to leak some additional information about the order of how this thing is constructed, and I'll come back to that a bit later. So like many data mining problems.
Can you tell what the input, what is the data that they have? Like, what is the input and what is. So the graph is what they're trying to compute.
The graph is what they're trying to compute. What they have some large table split in two down the middle. Alice has the right half, Bob has the left half.
Same. About all the same people.
So there are some issues with how you would know that without first doing something else or how you would get to that state. I'll come back to
but
that.
But how is the node and the graph related to the data?
So the nodes, each column represents one node. So the orange nodes here, those are the columns that Alice holds. So she has these three columns, and Bob has these columns. He has all the data items relative to those columns. Okay. So like many data mining algorithms, determining the best Bayesian network structure to represent some given data is NP-hard. And so heuristics are used in practice. And the K2 algorithm is a widely used heuristic for learning good Bayesian networks from a bunch of data. And so we use that as a starting point for our solution, meaning that our goal is going to be to compute the same results that the K2 algorithm would if it had all the data together. And what it does is it considers all the nodes, all the columns of the data in sequence, and then, so it starts with just this graph that's all the nodes, and then it starts adding edges by looking at one node at a time, adding to it a parent, whichever parent most increases some score function f, which sort of relates to probabilities or combinations represented in the data as an evidence about their probabilities, up to at most u parents per node. And the reason for this maximum on u, there's two reasons. One is, as I said before, if you get too many edges, that's actually usually not as useful for the data miners. And the other is that even the K2 algorithm before privacy is involved is going to be exponential in u. And so you want to keep that quite small. And notationally, we're thinking of m variables, so m columns in the data, and n records. And typically, you're thinking of n being quite large and being relatively smaller. So sort of a pseudocode version of very much the same thing. And also, this is the introduced some notation.
To understand, so the Bayesian network represents your assumption about the relationship of various fields to each other?
So if you constructed one from scratch, that would represent your assumptions. What I'm going to try to do here, what the K2 algorithm does, is it says, give me a bunch of training data, I'm going to take that as representative of underlying probabilities in some world, and I'm going to try and learn those probabilities from the underlying data.
The graph itself, is it fixed? The graph itself is fixed?
No, the graph is the output we're trying to construct.
Oh, the graph is, and you're saying it's fixed.
That's right. So there's sort of, you know, the philosophical question of what is the real probability space here. If we just knew it, we could write the real graph, but we don't typically know it. And then there's the mathematical question, which is given some data and some notion of good fit of a given Bayesian network to that data, you would want to construct the best one, and that would be NP-hard.
So you're just saying you take some algorithm and show how to implement it.
That's right. I mean, so we take an algorithm the data mining community has, you know, thinks is very good. They've actually improved on it in various ways for different applications, but this is a sort of a classical Bayesian network algorithm, and we're going to take that as our goal. So it might be we could come up with something different that would actually be better or would actually be worse, but we're going to talk about accuracy with respect to this algorithm.
But yeah. In general, it looks like the graph will be complete. You're just saying this algorithm somehow proves things which are like these.
Well, no. So, I mean, there may be some attributes that are completely independent of others, and so you wouldn't want those edges at all. And this maximum of u also sort of says you're going to prune out weak relationships, even if they're there.
So, for this purpose, we don't need to even care to understand what the graph is, which I didn't exactly understand, but I shouldn't care.
I want to do a secure function evaluation. Okay. So, if you're comfortable with that starting point, that's a fine starting point for understanding the whole rest of the talk. Yeah. Okay. And other questions? So this is just a more pseudocode version of what I said before. So at any given point, which way is the session looking at my trend? There we go. So it's going to go iteratively through it. At any point, this pred I is the set of possible parents that you could add. Remember, this has to be a directed acyclic graph, so you can't add any parent that would create a cycle of node I. So I is going to be one of the possible variables or attributes or columns or now nodes in the graph. And pi I is the current set of parents for node I. So we're going to go through each of our m nodes, start with an empty set of parents, and we're going to keep adding as long as we don't have a reason to stop. And in particular, we might stop if we have too many parents already. If we already have u parents, we won't keep going. So what we're going to do now, there's this scoring function f that it uses. So this is, as it's going through to see which of the possible parents it wants to add, it computes this score function f of I with a candidate set of parents that it already has versus I with a set of parents it already has plus one new parent z from the possible parents that it is not already considering and sees which gives the maximum score. If the maximum score comes from not adding a new parent at all, it says, okay, I'm done with this node, even if I didn't reach my u parent, so this would be a case where you wouldn't get a complete graph as well. Or if adding some node z gave me the maximum score, then I'm going to go ahead and add z to my set of parents and go back to see if I have u parents yet. If not, keep going. So that's the K2 algorithm. It does it for all of the nodes and goes through in sequence. And so our algorithm is going to be very similar. It's going to keep that same iterative structure, and that's actually why we are going to leak that order in which the edges are added, but we're going to try not to leak anything else. And the way we're going to do that is using private subprotocols for Alice and Bob to now jointly determine which elements, and pretend for a moment that this G is still an F, so which element of adding no new parents or adding any one of the new possible parents yields the maximum score. Does the same thing, except that instead of Alice and Bob learning the new score, they only learn random shares. And the only reason we have a G here and not an F is because in order to, for us to solve the problem privately, we approximated F a little bit with a different score function G. And so, you know, it might be possible that you could use exactly the same score function F and do it efficiently, and that's open. What we did was modify it a little bit. And the way that we modified it, before I can tell you, let me show you the K2 one. So this F score function that they use, it relies on something called alpha parameters, and these are really measuring the evidence of probabilities by counting up what different combinations appear in the data. So this alpha ijk, you don't need to really absorb all of this. You should view this as being the number of records in the database that are compatible with or times certain values appear in the data. And this relates to the node I and its possible parents, instantiations, and a possible value. So this alpha ijk measures the number of times that some assignment of all of the variables in I and its parents appear in the data. And we'll also need to know, just to have all our terms defined, that di is the number of possible values of variable I. So if you were dealing with just binary data, di would be 2 for everything. But this works for general discrete data as well. Okay, and then the score function that's going to be used then to determine which edge to add, it's going to look at a node I and a set of parents of I, and it's going to do, and again I'm not going to even try to get you to assimilate this, but it's going to do a factorial computation, it's going to do a division, it's going to do some multiplications, and it's going to do this over all possible instantiations of the node I and its parents. So what you should think about is you know, we know probabilities are related to what you expect to appear, so in some sense this is measuring our probabilities, and the higher score, a score is, it, the more it's saying that these frequencies represent that particular correlation. Yes? So, right, alpha ij is over all the possible k values of I. So alpha ij, let me see if I'm getting this right. I think this is if you fix a value for I and now you just want to know all the values for its parents.
Yeah. Yes?
Right. If you start with a different order that you're going to look at the nodes, you will get a different graph, and that's something that usually either you want to just take a random order so that you don't have some fixed bias, or more often an expert will sort of give some ideas of what they think they know about the data and what they want to use it for, which kinds of correlations they care more about. You know, do they want to be able to compute this from that or that from that? Bayes' rule sort of says you can take any one structure and change it around by going through, but right, it is true that the K2 algorithm is somewhat sensitive to the order in which you consider the nodes, and we don't address that in any other way. So, am I supposed to be done now? Okay, I'll be done soon. So what we do is we approximate the score, as I said, and actually, we don't approximate the score, but we approximate this G. It has the same relative ordering, because remember, all we care about really is which is the maximum. So we don't actually care about the absolute values, we just care about the relative values. So we approximate it in a way that we get the same relative ordering, lends itself well to private computation using existing tools that are out there. So we apply the natural log to F, we use Stirling's approximation for the factorials, we drop a constant factor and a bounded term, and actually the dropping of the term and the Stirling's approximation, or where we introduce some approximation rather than having exactly the same ordering, the result looks something like this. So we see that, you know, things that were factorial turned into logs, things that were products turned into sums, where L is this thing here and P is publicly computable by things that Alice and Bob know. So then our main task is to do a private computation of these various alpha parameters using the definition from before, so that we can get these alphas. And really, we don't want to get the alphas because that would reveal more than we're allowed to reveal to Alice and Bob. We want to get secret shares of the alphas. We want to be able to do a private score computation, which takes the shares of the alphas and builds up shares of this function here, this g function. And then we need to be able to do a private score comparison, which says, given these shares of all of these possible parent scores, which one actually is the maximum. And so we have protocols to do each of those that I'll just very briefly talk about. And in all of these cases, let me again stress that all the intermediate values, the scores and the parameters, are shared using secret sharing, and our privacy is respected to an honest but curious adversary, so not a malicious adversary. And you guys all know, certainly by now you know secret sharing, even if you didn't this morning. Additive homomorphic encryption we also saw today, and Pallier's crypto system is an example. Private scalar product. What this is if you have two bit vectors, or you can think of these as column vectors, the length of the data sets, Z and Z prime held by Bob. Now there's zeros and ones in them. This lets Alice and Bob compute secret shares of the scalar product, ZZ prime, which is the number of places they both have one in their data. And for example, there's a nice paper by some people whose names I can't remember that talk about a number of solutions that have been proposed in various settings and prove one of them secure. And then we also make use of a secure log computation, which is given an X shared between Alice and Bob, computes shares of LNX and SLNX, and that comes from the Little Kings paper. So given that, now we're sort of ready to put everything together and walk through this computation. So given the databases, Alice has her left part of the database, Bob has the right part, they both know that they're dealing with some particular variable I, some particular instantiation of the values of the parents, and some particular value of that variable I, as well as the set of the parents. It's going to output random shares, so they're each going to get a random share in a 2 out of 2 sharing of this alpha ijk. And so how do they do that? Well, so remember, what is this alpha ijk? As I said, this was just, we just want to know, given, we have this huge database, we want to know how many records in the database have, blonde hair, incomes between 100,000 and 200,000, visited Asia last year. And Alice can tell she has, so many that are compatible with, say, the blonde hair and the income, and Bob knows about the Asia, but they have to figure out how many are in common. And so to do this, they're going to use the scalar product. Basically, Alice is going to go through and create a vector just looking at each of her partial records to say, okay, zero if this one is not compatible because I already see the hair isn't blonde, or one if it's compatible, at least as far as my information. Bob does the same thing. And the number that they want to know now is how many of them do they have in common? How many do they both have one? So that you have both halves being compatible, they use the private scalar product protocol to do that and to obtain shares of that number, that alpha ijk. From there, once they've got these random shares of the alpha ijk, then we want them to be able to get random shares of any of these scores, gi pi I, for a set of possible parents of pi I. Remember, that formula looks something like this. So it's got the alpha ijs that we've already got the shares of, and now we have to do these other, the logs, the addition, the subtraction, the L's, the P, the sums. And so there are basically 5 types of things that we need to be able to do that. For the log alpha ijk and the alpha log alpha, we can use the Little and Pickus computations. For L, they can compute the new shares locally, because remember, this was just a sum of things they already have shares of. And once they've got the shares of L, then again for the log L and L log L, they can use Little and Pickus, and then everything else can be done locally. Computing P, since it's based on public parameters, multiplications by half, the additions can all be computed locally. So now they have, they can do that for all the different possible parents of a given node, and then they need to figure out, given these shared scores, which one of them is maximum. And in this case, we're just going to invoke Yao. So we've got, at this point, M inputs. Remember I said M is the number of columns, usually much smaller with respect to N, the number of things in the database, and the things themselves are quite small. It's just 2 field elements here. And so we're going to invoke at this point, two-party in our case, general secure computation, because you know, essentially just assuming M is enough smaller than N, this is not the significant cost of the protocol.
Sorry, at some point you must have mentioned, so it's at each iteration I know what's the current set of candidate parents and I'm just adding to the set.
Right.
So this is the information that this algorithm reveals is the current.
Exactly. So there's a certain amount of coordination between Alice and Bob about what order we're going to go through everything, and as they do this, what they're going to learn at the end as the result of this is not the score that gave the maximum, but they are going to learn this is the maximum, we are now both adding this edge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, that does, you can certainly construct some small counterexamples where you could force that plus perhaps some auxiliary information to reveal something that wouldn't be revealed otherwise. But you know, the hope is that it's you know, not too significant.
Why do you need to reveal the score? Can you just
we don't reveal the score.
Yeah.
Exactly. So here it doesn't reveal the shared the score, but it does reveal which one is maximum, because otherwise they wouldn't agree about whether the edge was added, whether to move on. And which set of parents were still there. So, you know, again, it may be possible to come up with a sort of completely different way of attacking the problem that doesn't have to reveal that, but that's open. So just to recap then, what that did is allowed us to do this private sub-protocol for Alice and Bob to determine which yields the maximum score, and that lets them do the rest of this as well. And because we're still keeping this structure, we're allowing them to learn at the end which one was the maximum score. We are revealing this extra information. In terms of performance, the inner loop of this K2 algorithm runs O of mu times, remember u is the maximum number of parents that we're going to add. Each time it requires O of u, and u is certainly no more than m, because you can't add more than all the possible parents to compute, each of which requires O of m times d to the u alpha parameters to be computed. This is where I said that the algorithm is exponential in u. That's not caused by our privacy, just by the, you know, that's inherent to the K2 algorithm, and where D is the bound on these DIs, the number of values for each possible variable. Each of these alpha parameter computations, though, and there's a number of them, including the scalar product protocol itself, require O of N computation and communication. This is the only place that N, the number of records, comes into the complexity. Everything else can be done within the polynomial of M and D to the U communication and computation, and again, as we do leak this order in which the edges were added, you can prove that nothing else is leaked. So I think I'll skip. I was going to talk a little bit about, you know, so even if you had lots and lots of these sort of privacy-preserving solutions for every kind of data mining algorithm out there, would you be done? And you sort of wouldn't, in the sense that there's sort of systems-y issues, there's data pre-processing. How do you even get to the state that Alice and Bob have this? We have some initial work on filling in holes in the data.
What is imputation?
Imputation is if you have a hole in the data and you use the rest of the data as evidence of how you should fill it. And there's various ways of doing that, including taking simple averages and more sophisticated things like building classifiers and doing things like that. So we have some initial work there, but a lot needs to be done. This is a big one. So coming back to Yale's point, you know, who does these things? So some data miner created lots of algorithms, but in the end, some analyst is sitting there with, you know, at this point, I think they have pretty sophisticated toolkits that let them look at data in different ways and do different things. And so if you want to provide that same kind of utility and usability experience to a data analyst, you need to, you know, often they'll like run some distributions on some data to get a feel for it and then do something else. So you need to provide them some way where without losing the privacy that your core pieces, your algorithms are supposed to be giving, that you let them do the kinds of things that they wanted to be done. And there's other things as well. So I think I'll skip the conclusions because they're sort of silly anyway. So I can take more questions if there are any. Yeah.
Is this algorithm suitable for multiple parties?
This one, as written, is not. Let's see. So I think pretty much. So if you have a multi-party scalar product version or something like that, where you just have it you're comfortable across, you can really use that. You secure multi-party computations instead on the score computation.
Can you do some iterative process of like two of the adding one?
I'm not sure.
We should
talk about it. Depend what you reveal. You know, if you just have two do the work and compute something, then pass it to a third. That's a little problematic. Yeah.
you said that instead of computing the score as prescribed by the K2 algorithm, you compute some kind of approximation, which
right.
is probably about as good.
Right.
But do you actually leak anything by the approximation more than the original K2 algorithm?
Right. So I think we did not do our homework and actually prove that it was a private approximation in the sense of the function not leaking.
The original K2 is arbitrary. So
right, 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 right. And we sort of make that, you know, both in terms of the accuracy and the privacy, you could argue that. But we have no reason to believe that it doesn't, but actually I think you're right that that's not something we explicitly address.